Can we return again to the, you were talking about the new printing machine that was being transported from London to
the new cylinder, just a huge cylinder now, you know.
Yeah,
the 85 new, ton weight actually.
Is that what it was?
That's 85 ton. Yeah.
Now, in order to the logistics of getting that across,
hell of a job. There was a police. I was in England when it was loaded onto the lorry in that low loader, you know, and there was a squad of police there. They went ahead of it and behind it all the way to Liverpool. And they had to, of course, all the bridges, the length, the heights of the bridges and all of that had to be taken into account. They had to pick special routes to get there. And when it arrived here in Dublin, same thing applied again. You had to have, you couldn't go under low-lying bridges or anything like that. This is so big. So they did get it out to Clondalkin and it was fitted in Clondalkin eventually.
And was that made specially for the mills?
Made specially for the mill, yeah. Car in the foundry. It was about... It's about the diameter of this room, but in height now it could be from, I suppose, it's hard to know the height now. I suppose maybe another half times the size of the height of this room.
Where was it made?
Wamsley in Lancashire.
And the to get it down here, now I heard that you had to knock walls and do all kinds of things.
That's right, yeah.
Was it, you know, did you have to... install that?
I wasn't involved in the company that shifted it from Wamsley's to Ireland. That was a company that specialised in that kind of work. I had nothing to do with that at all. And I was actually over in England on another... I was over in Wamsley studying grinding. But I happened to be there at the very time when this cylinder was finished and I saw it being loaded onto the low loader and saw it on its way. And that was that. But I had no real involvement in it other than that, you know.
I
just happened to be there when it was being done, you know.
And all the photographs you took of us would be very interesting.
Yeah, I'll show you that. I'll get to the photograph. But it'd take me time. Yeah. We have reams of photographs here.
Oh, thank you.
Can you talk to me then about the... You were saying that there was difficulties with pumps. That was your main concern, the pump.
There was one particular pump on one of the machines that gave constant trouble. A huge big pump, a big brute of a thing, gave constant trouble. And he couldn't seem to get it into the heads of any of the engineers that it was just no use, wasn't suitable for the job. And I told this Bruce Shaha, the American engineer, about that. And he listened carefully and he said, OK, and about 2 days after he said to me, there's a new pump on the way. He bought a new pump for that. This is now when... the Canadians took over and Bruce Shaha was now the only
towards
engineer
towards the end
there.
Of its time.
Yeah. He was the only engineer there. But I explained to him about this pump and like it just wasn't suitable for the job. And yet we'd had it for about 25 years there. Nothing but trouble all the time. nobody seemed to bother about it, you know. And you tried to tell people and they just weren't interested, you know. And it must have cost an awful, just that pump alone must have cost an awful lot of money to keep replacing all the time. We had two of them, you see. One of them would be working, the other one would be repairing it at the shop. Because it would take a lot to repair it as well, you know. Then when we'd have it all repaired, the one that was installed would be giving trouble, leaking in the glands and all of that. They'd decide to take it out some Sunday and there'd be two fitters on to take that pump out and bring it up to the shop and put the other one in. And I'd get the job of repairing them all again, you know.
And exactly, you weren't an engineer as such.
I wasn't an engineer. I served my time to the engineering trade, though, in GSR. Actually, when I was halfway through my time, the government bought out all the railways, including the GSR. So I finished serving my time in CIE. But I started in GSR, Great Southern Railway.
And what was your correct title then in the factory, in the mills?
In the mill, my foreman, engineering foreman.
Yes.
Or engineering supervisor. I think that's what they call us, actually.
And before you were that, you were...
I was a fitter.
A fitter.
Fitter and turner, yeah, that's right. Engineering fitter, yeah.
And when it came to switching on this new machine... Did you notify the ESB to let them know that this... Because it must have taken a huge amount of power.
Oh, it would, yeah, yeah. I don't know exactly what they used to do there. I know in the groundwood plant, That's a different. That's where they used to make the pulp. When they got the big stone there first for grinding, I was telling you, they used to grind the timber into pulp. And every time they wanted to start that motor up, they used to have to ring the ESB first. Because if they didn't, if they started the motor, it would shut down half of Dublin, I believe. So we used to have to ring the ESB, and they'd start get more,
more power.
Organised, yeah. So I presume when any of the big, eventually the ESB were able to handle all that without us ringing them. But in the early days, we used to have to ring them. If they're starting that big stone up in the ground plant, you had to ring them and tell them.
Yeah. Did you get holidays during the
year? Oh, we did, oh yeah. Foreign holidays. Yeah, and then we
would everything close down?
You mean then everything, what do you mean?
All the machinery, would everything stop?
Oh, the only time things stopped in the mill was during the first fortnight in August, when the mill workers all went on strike, went on holidays. But that was the time we were busiest, because as he was telling you there a minute ago, we were working night and day for that fortnight.
What were you doing working for that fortnight?
Oftentimes installing new equipment, but certainly repairing all the old equipment. So we were working all the time for that fortnight. That was their busiest time of the year.
Awesome.
And they'd be planning that for 3 months beforehand. A paper machine, when you start up a paper machine on a Monday morning, it runs the whole week. A paper machine is not like something that you start up and shut it down at the end of the day and start up again the next day. You don't do that. You start one up and leave it running for the week. Sometimes, we used to, coming up to Christmas now each year when there'd be a demand for paper, the paper machines would run all the time, maybe for 3 weeks non-stop. Start up on one Monday morning and wouldn't stop for 3 weeks, just keep running the whole time. So when machinery is running like that, there's a lot of maintenance on it, you know.
And so, Gertrude, you mustn't have seen much of
not for that fortnight. And unfortunately, the children were off school.
Yeah.
So we'd be able to do nothing, you know. He'd be busy, and even it would run after that sometimes, you know. So that fortnight was completely out, you know. Yeah. So
I did get well paid.
Yeah,
I didn't in the beginning. In the beginning, we as the foreman, I was making far more money as a fitter than as a foreman. And for some years, I was working as a foreman, and you were told, like, you're on the staff and all, you don't have to be clocking in or clocking out. But nevertheless, you were getting phone calls at night, at maybe at 2 a.m, your phone would go and you'd have to go into the mill. And you might be there for 3 hours, maybe 6 hours, maybe 8 hours. You might be there. We didn't get any extra money for it. And what happened then was the four of us got together one day. There was four of us there doing this particular job. And we were doing all the call-ins. The engineers didn't get call-ins, you know. Our brief was, if you're called in at night, there's a breakdown on one of the machines. If we thought that it was going to last longer than 4 hours, we were supposed to ring an engineer. But if some of those engineers, if you'd ring them, you wouldn't get much of a reply. One of them, I remember, was married to a doctor, and she said, "Oh, Mr. I won't say his name, isn't here. He's has a golf match. He's down in Arklow or something like that." You'd never get the engineers in. So we'd have to do it ourselves. You'd never dream of ringing Terry O'Neill now, for instance. He was above all that. You know? But you could ring Lynch, John Lynch. He was the only engineer that we found. You could ring him at night and he'd come in, you know. But if the thing was going to last 4 hours, I'd ring Lynch. And he was one man, he was a bit of a worrier, you know. But I'd ring him and he'd say, "I'll go in." I'd say, "No, listen, don't come in. I'd ring you, because I have to ring you, but everything will be all right. It'll take about 6 hours. It'll be okay." And he said, "I'll go in." I said, "Don't come in. Listen, go to bed. And say, if I won't be long about ringing you if I'm in any trouble." But mostly he'd often come in, despite the fact not telling him. But the rest of the engineers, they played a different game. They were very hard to get at night.
Oh, listen, I could stay and talk to you all day. It's a great story.
I meant to tell you the other thing was that we got no extra pay for it, you see.
Yeah.
And one day, anyway, we were chatting and we decided, anyway, we'd have a go at maybe joining a union. So we contacted a fella in Belfast, and we joined DATA. That's Draftsmen and Technicians Union. And we met him in a pub up in, where was it, up in Tallaght somewhere. And we met him in a pub and we had a discussion with him. And we, he asked us, what were you paid now? And we told him, see, do you get paid for call-ins? No, he said, we don't. Do you get paid for Saturday work? No. Do you get paid for Sunday work? No. And we get a day off. We used to get a day off. If you work Saturday or work Sunday, you get a day off for it. But sometimes you wouldn't even get that day off because, you know, there'd be, some of your mates would be in on break-ins, your breakdowns during the week. So it might come a week and you'd be after work on Saturday and Sunday and get no day off the next week. Get scared to tell you. But anyway, this union man asked us all these questions. And he said, you know, he said, you lot are mad, he said. And he showed us, opened up a book and he showed us different wages and various places in Dublin. I forget, he mentioned various other companies around Dublin. He said, you should be getting paid for call-ins. You should get paid for Saturday work, paid for Sunday work, and paid an extra money, he said, for those works. So we said, no, we're not going to bother about that. And he said, well, he said, you're mad, he said. So about 6 months went by, and we found the company would kind of begin to annoy us a bit, shifting us around and all like that. So we decided to get him. We rang him. He came in and he saw the company. And he told, we were all up in the office with him. And he told the management there, he said, these men, he said, are going to be paid for call-ins, paid for Saturday work, paid for Sunday work, special pay for them. And anyway, he just said that, you're going to have to do that. And the next day, we were called up again to the management there. We told, okay, have all that. So we got paid for a call-in.
And he made the difference. And so yeah. He was a union man. Yeah, from what union again?
DATA. D-A-T-A. DATA and Technical... I forget the other word. That was the name of the union. Yeah. So anyway, we got it, no problem. We were entitled to it. All the other men in similar positions in factories around Dublin were all getting it, but we weren't getting it. So it ended up that I was getting, if I got a call in, I'd get £8 an hour, and that was for a minimum of 4 hours. So even if I was called in, I might only be half an hour in the mill. I still had to get 4 hours pay for it at eight euros an hour. It wasn't that much now, really, but nevertheless, it was better than doing it all for nothing.
Yes, it was indeed. Listen, Gertrude and Tony, thank you both very much for talking to me. Yeah. It was a great story.
Yeah. Just tell you about my uncle, by the way. I was going to tell you there, this uncle of mine that's in the First World War, he was only 16, he joined the army, and he was killed in the Battle of the Marne. It was the first 3 weeks of the war in September 1914, and he was only 16. He was killed, and his older brother was in the army already. And my grandmother got the word back then, you know, about Philip had been killed, and Tommy was the elder brother who was already in the army. He actually found Phil. He was involved in the Battle of the Marne too. He didn't even know Phil was in the army, but he found Phil, found him dead. So he told his mother that he buried Phil, you know, and Phil was all right. He saw it, he was buried and all that. And years went by, and my mother often said to me, it was great the way Tommy found Phil and had him, you know, buried properly and all like that. So anyway, eventually I was talking to Tommy's oldest daughter, who'd be older than me, a lot older than me. And she said, now at this time her family had, her father and mother had died, said, you know, my dad always said that he buried Phil, but he didn't. He found Phil's body all right, but he said he couldn't, he wasn't a burial detail. He couldn't bury anyone. He said he couldn't stop to do that. So that poor chap now joined the army. That's the photograph. I had it over there. I picked it out the other day. I want to get the mark taken off his face. That's all I want to do, you know.
Well, I am definitely going to come back and talk to you about that
story.
Thank you very much.
So he didn't bury Phil anyway, as it turned out, you know.